Oh, God, I haven't been in the studio in a long time. It feels a little foreign to me. I hope I do it right. We are talking about dealing with challenges, taking on challenges, and all the things that happen along the way. Everybody, my name's Bill Gallagher. I'm your scaling coach, host of the Scaling Up Business Podcast. Bring our show to you every week, I think, most of the time, except when I go on vacation. And we bring our show to you every week, and we talk about all the things to do with leadership, with growing and scaling your organization, your department, like whatever it is that you're interested in growing. That's our show. So all those shows and more, like for 5 years now, at scalingcoach.com. Scalingcoach.com is where we've got those shows, and you can find out about our coaching and things like that to help companies grow and scale and have a good time. It doesn't have to suck. It doesn't have to be that hard to do this. So I'm joined now by Shailee Basnet from Nepal. She's Nepali, and I met her recently in San Francisco. She's going to be doing an event here. We'll talk more about that. But in 2008, she summited Everest. You know, it's not like a normal thing to do. And although she looks the same height as me, I'm not particularly tall. She's a small woman. Anyway, here's this woman who summited Everest and a whole bunch of other peaks and led other women on it. And it's just not normal. It's unusual. And she's got great stories to share on it. And she's a delight to talk to. Welcome, Shailee, to the show.
Thank you, Bill. I'm excited to be here. This is super fun.
Yeah. So let's start with why you ever did this in the first place. You know, what has you wake up one day? I mean, I guess it's your backyard if you're from Nepal, right? Not exactly my backyard. But what has you go, oh, I want to do that? What do you even get into mountain climbing?
So my background is I was born and raised in Kathmandu, and everything was great, middle-class family, you know, educated parents. The school I went to was awesome for studies, for academics, but there was no sports. There was no sports even for boys, but especially for girls. We're ridiculed by teachers if we're physically being active, playing around, jumping around, running around. So when I was in my teens, I thought, okay, I got a good brain and I can go anywhere in the world and make a life, you know, have a yes. good life, but I have no idea what my body can do. So I need to figure out what my body is able to do. It was just a curiosity, like what can my body do? And like you said already, I do tell people that I'm 5 feet tall on a good day, which is not today. When I put on heels, I'm 5 feet tall. So here's, you know, somebody with a baby face, petite, and I've never played sports, but there was this fire in my belly that I am born as a human being. I got to figure out, I'm very excited to figure out all my potential, physical, you know, mental, spiritual, you know, financial, creative, like I want to scale all these mountains. So I was like, okay, I need to give it a shot. And when I found out there was a female expedition being put together for Everest, I knew, like, this was my chance. This is my ticket to adventure. So that's how it started for me. And surprisingly, ironically, despite being home to Everest and Himalayas in Nepal, there were very few women in mountaineering. This is the year 2007. Till then, there were only 7 women from our country who would climb this mountain. So even when you wanted to meet somebody from Nepal, a woman from Nepal who's climbed Everest, it was very hard to find even one, you know, to sit down with. So this expedition was organized because my leaders of this expedition thought that it was high time more Nepali women had access to mountaineering. And that's how this expedition was born. And I came to know about it. And then I just signed up for it.
Yeah, I love it. I a couple things I notice in this is, one is, there you are in life. And you're hungry for something. You feel like something a little bit missing, hungry for something that you don't have. And then you hear, you see something and you're like, yes, I'm doing that. And you know, it's useful to have enough self-awareness to notice that you're missing something that you want. And it's even more unusual to see something and then just seize it to say, yes, I'm going to join that expedition. So tell us about the expedition then. What happened? And well, I know we're going to get into all the things that happened since, but let's talk about that.
First of all, speaking of self-awareness, I mean, I was aware what I was missing, but at the same time, I'm also aware that, you know, I'm not an athlete. I don't have much, you know, experience in just being sporty or athletic. I'd never even really hiked, you know, and so, and then my figure, my age, my shape, size, and all of it. I used to be probably 90 pounds. So, you know, when I thought of a climber, my kind of image was not the one I thought of. So I had to be real. And as ambitious and confident I was, at the same time, I was like, well, am I cut out for Everest? Well, that was a real question. And this is signing up for something very, very risky. So my first question to my leaders was, how are you going to decide who's good enough for this expedition or not? And they told me that it's not something you'll go and climb tomorrow. There'll be almost a year-long program. And that will start with 45 days of intense mountaineering training in the Himalayas. So this is a course designed for professional mountain climbers, you know, popularly known as Sherpas, who've been working and guiding people in the mountains. So this is a certification course for them. And there were so few women every year. There were barely even a single woman who was applying for this. So, you know, there was a place, a kind of a reservation, let's say, for women. And that's how I got in. So here, you know, we were five from my original team of, you know, Everest climbers, one of the Everest climbers. And we're training together with some 25 plus men, professional mountain guides. So that was my first introduction to the outdoors. And I was not impressive at all. I was very slow. I still remember this one day, we go for this trek, right? And then we probably stop maybe around 10,000 feet and we've walked maybe 5 hours or so. And that's the first time in my life that I've trekked. And next morning, I still remember we're in this little wooden cabin and there were maybe five of us, like girls, like huddled in one room. I was sleeping on the floor inside my sleeping bag. And when I woke up, everything waist down was numb, like totally numb. I couldn't move anything. And there's this kind of pain, you know, from my waist down to my toes. So, and this is maybe around 5 a.m. And I was so embarrassed because I was like, here I am training with these strong, you know, men in this elite course. And I'm here to, you know, hopefully climb Everest in some time. And after one day of trek, I can't even move. Like I'm paralyzed or something. I'd never experienced that before. So I was worried and I was a little embarrassed in myself. And nobody was up at this time. So I was like, okay, can I get out of this sleeping bag? So I just crawl out of the sleeping bag. And I was like, okay, I can manage that. So can I, you know, walk to the door? I get up and then I walk to the door and I get out. And there's this wooden balcony. And it's the lush green vegetation, you know, this mountain forest with tall trees and bushes and shrubs. And the river is like just spraying all these green leaves. So I was like, oh my God, I'm in this paradise. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to take a moment and not panic and just enjoy this. And as I was watching that, I was like, okay, let me pace back and forth. So I'm pacing back and forth. Then I was like, okay, I think I can do this. So let me go brush. So I get my toothpaste and toothbrush. I brush and I'm enjoying the view and all of that. And by the time I finished brushing, I was totally normal. So I learned at that moment that, you know, the pain and suffering you get from walking too much can only be healed by walking again. So by the time everybody else was up and, you know, everything, I didn't tell a single soul what happened in the morning. I kept shut. And I was like, I know if it happens again, what I can do. But I think that was my body just breaking into this, you know, walking for several hours in high elevation. After that, it never happened. So I was not impressive at all. I had to earn every single ability that I later had to climb Everest.
Let's keep going in just a second. I wanna acknowledge something though that I certainly have experienced, and I think a lot of our folks did, an underlying principle there that I think is really great, and that is, in the middle of a profound challenge and even like a moment of panic, like something's wrong here. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. I don't belong here. This isn't how it should be, right? You took a small step and then you connected with something bigger beyond yourself. And I can remember in 2001 and in 2008-09, when it seemed like the world, or the world I knew, was like changing and the ground wasn't, I would just look out my window and I would see these grand trees that have been there through hundreds of years, through, you know, many periods. And I would notice the birds coming and going, and I would be like, okay, like whatever events just happened in New York and so on, it, like life still continues. It's like there's something still going on. And I've since been taught like the like to take an awe walk, to go into nature and to allow yourself to be awed by something powerful and large and enduring, and or whatever it is that can awe you. It could be also a very small thing, but that like the recenter and reorient, and then, you know, your legs start to work again, or your sense of yourself, and you do some small things, and like really powerful there to connect with something beyond your own. Like, because if you spool internally, like, my legs aren't working, I'm not meant for this, and I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm only 90 pounds, and I'm a woman, and like it just goes on. And that internal dialogue isn't really helping us all the time.
No. And I've learned, I've had many other, you know, mishaps and accidents and failures along the journey, both on the mountain and off the mountain. And I think what I've learned in looking back is that failure is how you respond, you know, to something. Failure is actually just emotion, just feeling. So, okay, I cannot walk, or, you know, somebody is struggling with his last breath next to me, you know, and you have all these questions of, why am I here? What are the chances it could be you? And so to take a pause at that moment and just realize, this is your mind. You know, this is your mind thinking of things, you know? Yeah. So failure is kind of being sucked into that rabbit hole. And success is being able to take that pause and make an assessment. I'm still fit. I'm still fine. I can still take that next step. I can still breathe. You're good. Let's focus on that. So that's success.
Let me ask you two questions about, so you're in this year-long training program?
Or yes, it mostly, was almost a year almost from a the year. Time yeah. I decided to climb to actually making it to the summit.
And with a mix of people, with women, men, all women?
So the idea was, you know, put forth by two Sherpa men, Dagomu Sherpa and Pema Dorje Sherpa. These were our leaders. And they selected kind of a team of 10 of us, 10 women. Mm-hmm. So it was, we were called First Inclusive Women Sagarmatha Expedition. Sagarmatha is the name for Everest. Our larger crew, including the 12 of us, was 33 people. So that includes our kitchen crew, our base camp manager, you know, our staff, like guides, high altitude guides, all of that. We're a crew of 33 people. Mm-hmm. And that's how, for the lack of a better term, commercial expeditions on Everest, standard expedition teams on Everest function. So the goal was to put as many of the 10 women on the summit of Everest as possible.
Now, the other women, were they also Nepali women, or were they from other parts of the world?
They were all from Nepal, but Nepal, if you look at the map of Nepal, we've got Himalayas on the northern side, you know, next to Tibet. And then we've got mid-hills. So I'm from Kathmandu, which is part of the mid-hills. So you can, there are these hills that a lot of foreigners call mountains. We make a distinction. If it's not a permanent snow cover, it's hills. But I can see mountains. So I can see not Everest, but other permanent snow cover, like few peaks from Kathmandu. And so that's mid-hills. And down south, we have flat plains. So we share open border with India. So it's maybe 100 or 200 feet above sea level. So it's absolutely flat. And this is our, you know, agriculture basket of the country, because there's very few agriculture. There's very little agriculture in the mountains, and then limited in the hills. So we are three different kind of terrain. And we had members come from all of these different topographies, various ethnicities. So we were a mixed bag of 10 women from various backgrounds in Nepal.
So the question I have for you is maybe two-part, answer any part you like. But what do you notice different about how men and women think about mountain climbing, and in particular this expedition and challenge of summiting Everest? What do you notice about the difference in that? And then do you notice anything different between the way we might think of it outside of Nepal versus in Nepal? I'm curious your thoughts on the different perspective of those two aspects of thinking about climbing a mountain like that.
I think Nepali and non-Nepali way of climbing, there's more of a cultural difference. And the fact that because we are a developing country, we're still in the survival mindset, at least when we were, you know, climbing Everest, we were in a survival mindset. So climbing mountain for a dream started as a very Western thing. And, you know, people in Nepal, in Tibet, you know, in this region, wherever we're assisting the Western expeditions, they did it to earn their livelihood. So it started as that. So for many generations, we just saw the continuation of that. And that's why you saw that, you know, Western people would come and climb a mountain and they would write a book or make a movie and they would become huge, you know, celebrities. And then maybe a team of 10, 20, sometimes even hundreds of people who supported that expedition risked their lives maybe 10 times more, didn't get the credit, right? So there's always that, and that is changing in today's time. I'm sure a lot of you have watched 14 Peaks, and you know, that is probably the most watched documentary on Netflix. If you haven't, you should. This, you know, young man from Nepal, he's climbed, he's met several world records, so he's bringing attention. Even my story of 10 women from Nepal climbing Everest, I am speaking to various, you know, groups. I'm doing talks at like Fortune 500 companies and, you know, big places. They want to hear from somebody like me. So that shift has just started happening. People are acknowledging the contribution and struggle of people from that side. So this is new and this is good to see finally happening. Besides that, the difference is cultural. So for example, when you're climbing in Nepal or when a Nepali team climbs in these other countries, like even when we're climbing in Denali, we'd welcome other teams. We'd serve them. We'd give them tea, you know, we'll give them a little snack. Whereas non-Nepali, a lot of non-Nepali people from different cultures, they would be reserved to themselves. And it's so exhausting to be in the mountain. You really don't have much bandwidth for hospitality. But some hospitality kind of is programmed in our DNA. So this is a feedback we keep getting when we're in the climbs that, oh, you are so hospitable and, you know, offering tea to guests and visitors, inviting people over. So it's a little more fun. There's a little bit of more of singing, dancing, chatting, you know, sense of community is definitely there a little more within Nepali, maybe South Asian communities. That's something I've noticed. When it comes to men and women,
you know, I just to underscore that before you go into the men and women thing, for years in a Western or Eurocentric kind of world, we learned about and celebrated Edmund Hillary. Today, I think more and more people know about Sherpa Tenzing and Tenzing Norgay, and even in the hotel near my house where we have meetings frequently, there's a room dedicated to him and a beautiful room. And, you know, along every Western explorer that attempted to summit, there was a whole team of people that he pointed out, and not just the people that went all the way to the summit, but everybody who cooked and took things up and prepared the camps and that kind of thing. And that's a whole like industry into itself.
It is. It takes a village to put one person on the summit.
Actually, I know many of our friends in the business world have just made the effort to go to the base camp and spend some time there and kind of see the environment. And that is an experience in itself, that whole thing.
It is. It takes about 10 days to trek to the base camp. If you want to trek, you could also fly. But if you fly, you just get a minute or two there. And the base camp of Everest is 17,500 feet. I'm married to somebody from Colorado, so I poke fun at him. He's like, you know, 14,000 feet mountains, and, you know, not being disrespectful, but just as a husband-wife banter, we're like, yeah, right, Everest, like base camp of Everest is 17,500 feet. So it's an experience and definitely an achievement just to get to the base camp of Everest for sure.
Yeah, that, you know, that's not a small altitude, and your thinking and your headaches and your energy level and everything like takes time at that altitude. So what do you notice about the difference of men and women in this environment in undertaking a challenge like this?
So my experience can only be anecdotal, and I was part of this team that, you know, we stuck together for 7 years, and you know, we are a very tight team. We have great bonding in our team. So I don't think if it was not for my team, I probably wouldn't sign up even for a single mountain. It was because we were a team and we're so close. We've shared our life and death together on a rope. You know, it's a sisterhood of rope for us. So I can probably only speak for my own team. We would have conflict, we'd have differences, we'd have fights, but if there was anything to measure the love and teamwork and that, you know, dedication to the common vision, then we were like 110. So I don't know if male expeditions work that way. I'm sure in history, there were probably some that did. There are a lot of stories we hear of, you know, people going to expeditions together and returning enemies and never talking to each other again. Which is understandable. They're even the best musical bands in the world split up, right? So it's not like, you know, you're signed up for life. So at least with my team, despite all the challenges and hurdles we faced, we had the clarity to stick together. So that really worked for us. Some of the things that we commonly hear is that with women, maybe because there are so few of us in this industry that we probably feel the need to find a team of supporters who will rally behind us rather than, you know, discourage us. So in order to find that, I think when we find women like ourselves, then I think chances of working together, the bonding, I think, becomes better.
So how many mountains have you... like major mountains have you climbed now?
So after climbing Everest, we decided to do the Seven Summits Challenge. And so from the Seven Summits Challenge, I've been on 5 mountains. I've made it to the summit of 4. On the 5th one, which is Aconcagua in Andes in Argentina, I couldn't make it to the summit. I was very close to the summit, but I decided to turn around. I had a frost nip, so I had to turn around, and so did 2 of my other friends. And the last 2 climbs, we couldn't do it because we didn't have enough funds for Antarctica, etc. So we only sent selected number of people from our team. So as a team, we've completed all 7 summits in 7 continents. So personally, I've not done all of that, but we're a part of team. So I'm very proud of it.
You should be. Yeah. Here. Cowbell for you. Yeah, that's quite a bit. And then when you think about those, were any of them harder or easier than you expected to be? What was different than your expectation as you went into them?
I think all the mountains have their own beauty and challenge. So, you know, just because you've climbed Everest, you cannot underestimate Kilimanjaro. There are people who suffer, even, you know, get into accident or die on Kilimanjaro. I think Kilimanjaro is overhyped as an easy mountain. Well, it's an easy mountain if you're a good climber, but it's still one of the toughest treks in the world. So there's that distinction. And we've seen people suffer a lot on Kilimanjaro. So in our case, all the mountains came with their own set of challenges and, you know, beauty. Where we made things good or bad for ourselves is when we were super trained, we're really good. And Everest should technically be the toughest to climb, but we're so prepared, mind, body, spirit, like we were so prepared. Like even if I know that even if God had appeared in front of me and said, you're not supposed to climb Everest right now, I'd be like, excuse me, God, you're on my way. You know, I was that clear. And so were all of my teammates. And no wonder all of us made it to the summit of Everest, which is a very rare, you know, achievement in Everest expedition. So that dedication, that all kind of preparation, that was our biggest strength on Everest and a number of other mountains. Aconcagua despite being much easier than Everest, I didn't make it. Two of my friends didn't make it because we underestimated the mountain. I used this mitten that I'd been using for a few years. And I was like, yeah, I just worked on all these mountains, you know, no big deal. It's just a smaller mountain. And that didn't work. And it is so crazy. At this little mountain town called Mendoza, we do a gear check. And, you know, on the day of the gear check, I'm checking all the gear and I'm looking at the mittens of four of my team members. And I was like, I was upset with them. I was like, you're here to climb a mountain. You don't even have good mitten. So we went to a store. We're always on like tight shoestring budget. I used my personal credit card and rented them four pairs of mittens. And their mittens were great. It didn't even occur to me to get one for myself. Because I was like, you know, my mittens have been working fine. So, you know, no biggie. And it didn't. And another friend of mine had similar gear issues. So in all honesty, when I you know, turned around and that evening in the tent, I'm still sleeping in the lap of Aconcagua in the Andes, right? And I'm like, I'm so close. I could see the summit with my eyes and I'm thinking, what went wrong? And I'm like, technically, yes, you didn't have the right gloves. So, you know, those mittens, that would have made a difference. But I knew deep within that I was in such a haste to climb mountain number five that somewhere I disrespected this mountain. I underestimated this mountain. And that's what cost me this. If it was not for the mitten, it probably would have been something else. So, the very idea, why do we climb? Because, you know, there's a deep connection you feel with the mountains, and that's why you climb these mountains. And I know that when I was climbing Aconcagua, that deep connection was compromised. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, then that's when mountains become difficult. And when that doesn't happen, even Everest was manageable.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a parallel there. There are many times where we think we've got something handled, where we take something for granted, where we relate to something as routine, and then it bites us in the butt. And it doesn't have to be a major, major mountain climb. It could be a simple sales call. And you get cocky, you get casual, and I know I do it all the time, and certainly the people we work with do, our listeners and viewers. What have you learned about yourself in the process of doing all this? What have you noticed? How have you changed?
So after climbing all these mountains, definitely you get a lot of confidence. And I've realized recently that, you know, after Everest, there was massive amount of confidence. We're young. We have this great success, you know, great achievement. But I do realize that that was a bit of an immature confidence, you know, like you said, being cocky. And we decided to climb the seven summits. We thought everybody would be writing us checks. We'll climb this mountain in a year. You know, it took us six more years. And so 6 more years of our prime youth, you know, when we should be excelling in our careers and personal life and all of that, we had to put everything on hold until we climbed these mountains. And so that was bit of a test. And so by the time we climbed the seven summits, we were a lot more mature. So after Everest, confidence but immature, and after seven summits, mature and confident. I would pick mature and confident any day rather than that immature confidence, because with that, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. And I would still do the seven summits. I'm not saying that I regret it. I'm absolutely proud of it. But the way we approach things, the way we approach mountains, that needed greater depth and maturity than just this high of that we did something great. Now let's go kill. So, yeah, even confidence has, I guess, different versions.
Yeah. Well, I met you recently in San Francisco. We're at a social event. And you said, oh, I'm doing comedy now. And I'm like, wait a minute, mountain climbing, like how do all these things relate? And you've got a comedy show coming up. Where did this comedy thing start? How does that connect?
So comedy was something I just picked up as a stress buster, you know, climbing mountains. And we've also been training young women who are survivors of girl trafficking in Nepal. And we helped them, mentor them for multiple years so that they can become trekking guides, you know, licensed professionals. So these are all very serious, heavy-duty work. I make my living as a keynote speaker where I talk about, you know, all these lessons in a more serious, inspirational tone, which I absolutely love doing. But when I was doing all of this work, I could also, you know, be aware that there's a part of my brain that sees the absurd in all of these situations. So in the worst of times when we should be crying in a tent or, you know, when we should be angry with other people, there would be a part of me that would be laughing because this world is really absurd. A lot of things here don't make sense, but then a lot of people don't talk about these things. So that, you know, observer in me at times used to annoy me because I would be like, I should be crying right now. Why am I laughing? What are these thoughts? You know, am I like, you know, is something wrong, like with my head or something?
Definitely.
And later when I realized that, you know, stand-up comedy is a art and it's a craft, I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what it is. So I really think that if I don't do stand-up comedy, I'll have to come back again, like in terms of reincarnate again, just to do comedy, because there's so much in my head that has been observed that it will need an outlet. So it's just an outlet. Fortunately for me, once I started doing comedy in Nepal, I've been visiting US for the last 10 plus years. So every time I would come here, I would also do some shows here. I started getting really good response. I've never lived in the US, 2013 when I did my first show. I'd never lived here till that time. I didn't go to school here, any of that. And yet when I went and did my 5 minutes, all of my jokes landed. People could understand me. So I was like, oh, okay. So my Nepali voice has some audience here. And then I kind of kept, you know, pushing the envelope. I went to New York. I played some big clubs there. Those went really well. So then, you know, going with the theme of your podcast, I was like, how do I scale this? And so now I'm preparing for this very big, ambitious show in San Francisco for this fall, October. The show is going to be called Mount Everest Diaries. And the idea here is to share these stories that we've been talking about, climbing Everest, the work I do with the, you know, survivors, talking about pioneers like Tenzing Norgay and, you know, Junko Tabe, the first female to climb Everest, talking about them, but using language of comedy, because entertainment is definitely more pervasive and it can go like much more mainstream. So I want all the girls following the Kardashians to know about Junko Tabe. Basically, that's my motivation.
Yes. Someone who did something more than strike a pose, right? Which is an art form in itself, but a pretty significant undertaking. That's really cool to take that on. So your show coming up, cityboxoffice.com, order tickets, and the show is
Mount Everest Diaries.
Mount so Everest Diaries.
People can just go to my website, which is just my name, shailibosnet.com. And from there, you can go to the City Box Office site and get your tickets. It's a family-friendly show. We really want to see young people. Maybe, you know, children above 10 years of age might be able to understand it more compared to 5 or 6 year old. But it's going to be a family-friendly show where you can bring your girls, boys, bring your friends, colleagues, and just enjoy the story of, you know, climbing Everest. When people think of climbing, they think of all the hardship and the serious things, you know, that people could die. But it's also a lot of fun to be in these mountains with a bunch of people who have not taken shower for 40 days. So all the fun stuff.
Well, there's hot showers, right? There's private marble bathrooms, right? You have some good things there in the mountain, right? If you get tired, you go to a cafe for a while. And it smells like what?
It smells like paradise.
I bet. You know, I think of mountains as a beautiful place, but then I go to the lodge, right? I go skiing for a little bit. The lift carries me up. We ski down very quickly, and then we have cocktails. Some really good wine.
Right.
That's a different journey. And so some of that is in the act itself. You tell the stories and share some of the humor and the absurdity of all of that, right?
Yes. So I talk about being from Nepal and, you know, how a lot of people don't even know about my country and, you know, just poke fun at where Nepal is, this beautiful country between India and China. I talk about myself. There's a lot of self-deprecation humor being less than 5 foot tall girl trying to climb this 29,000 feet mountain, the challenges of it. And the Sherpas in my team, they were very funny. When they saw me, they were very happy. Oh, so even if she falls, we can just lift her with one hand. So there'll be some self-deprecation and then some, you know, actual aspects of climbing Everest. I will definitely bring in the story of Junko Tabe, Pasanglamu Sherpa, the pioneer females that climbed before us. I'm really passionate about female narrative and developing world narrative. I really think that it's now the time, because I watch this best and brightest comics of our time, you know, these men who've been doing it for 30, 40 years, and they're still wife bashing. So I'm like, wait a minute, seriously, like, how much can we keep doing this? I'm like tired of this narrative. I mean, I'm like, if the women are so, you know, I don't know, sucking life out of people after the planet, where are the women leaders in business, in politics, in anything? And you're the most successful comic of our time, and you're still complaining about how your wife makes your life terrible. So I'm like, let's talk about these girls who were trafficked at the age of 9 and made their way back home at 16. And by early 20s, if you want to climb a mountain in Nepal, they can be your boss ladies. So what exactly is your problem, sir?
Tough. Yeah, tough.
So these are heavy duty topics. Some of the things I talk about are heavy duty, but I'm committed to using the language of comedy to bring it to more people.
Yeah. Make it accessible, put some balance to it. Well, let me remind our listeners, our show comes to you every week. If you want to comment, you add your comments here, whether you're watching on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, whether you're listening on Apple, iTunes podcast. I don't know what the app's called these days. Podcast, I guess. Stitcher, Spotify, etc. We love all of the different channels and all of the listeners. If you want to get in touch with us directly, send an email to info@scalingcoach.com or find us at scalingcoach.com. I think you can remember that, probably not too hard, at the end of your drive, run, or whatever it is that you listen to your podcast. Like, subscribe, all that. Give us a good review. All those things help us a great deal, and we thank you so much if you take the time to do that. If you get notified or you subscribe, you get them every week, and so you don't miss anything there. If we can help you find a coach or somebody to support you in your scaling journey, we'd love to do that. info@scalingcoach.com. I want to give a big shout out and thanks to my mentor and friend, Vern Harnish, author and creator of the Scaling Up book and the Rockefeller Habits that preceded it, and to the folks that help us produce our show, Wanda Mitchell in the background, who gets our show ready and produces things and gets things out the door, and the folks at Podfly Productions, Albert Burge and the others, who get the audio ready and clean things up and get it all out. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening, for watching. Keep scaling up. We'll talk to you again next time, and we'll see you at the show.